speak to a lot of women that feel a bit invisible in their current organization, or maybe feel like they're not getting the opportunities that their male counterparts are getting. Any advice when it comes to developing that mindset and that sort of self-belief and self-worth?
I think it does start with the individual. Do you like the person you see when you look in the mirror, and not about your hair or your eye color or those such physical attributes, but are you a nice person? Are you a good friend? Are you a good listener? These are sort of attributes that ideally we should all be able to articulate. A woman put her hand up and she asked on how to deal with men that speak over them in a boardroom. I said, do you have siblings? Yes. Are they brothers in that? Yes. I said, think about the last time you had a family lunch or a family birthday. And she said, yeah. And I said, now, when you spoke and your brother or your father spoke over you, what did you do about it then? And it was like a light bulb moment for her. And she was like, oh, wow. And I'm like, we can't presume that behaviours that happen around us and we allow to happen around us to suddenly be different because we've walked into an Oval Office with 12 chairs.
Siobhan, welcome to the Career Confidence Podcast today. I am honoured and excited to have you on as a guest. You've lived a very interesting life, and I'm going to dive into all of that today. And you've got a very interesting role at the moment of Chief Growth Officer of the Australian Computer Society. So we're going to dive into all of that today. But before we get into all the really sort of present stuff and the really good stuff, can you give a bit of an introduction into who you are, your background, and a little bit about your career journey as well? So Siobhan, over to you.
Thanks, Georgie. Lovely to be here as well. So thanks for inviting me on the show. Look, I have an interesting background. I think basically because I've been an advocate of saying yes to lots of things. And I know a lot of times in circles with particularly female leaders and women in their career, we're often encouraged to say no because we say we do too much and we stretch ourselves too thin. But I suppose mine's predicated on being curious. So I say yes to opportunities that I think would be good for my career or good for my learning. So I originally studied in hospitality management. Started focus on that, I think, from year 10 onwards. And as soon as I qualified my first course, I decided I didn't want to bring up my kids in a kitchen. Not that I had them, but the ones that I wanted to have, and pivoted straight away into a new career. Started working in human resources and did my second degree at night. Then moved to Ireland and worked with Guinness. And as you can tell from my name, I have Irish parenting. And my parents came out on a boat in 1970, so decided to go back and live there and just understand perhaps more about my parenting and heritage. And then came back and worked at Woolworths in a national HR role, and very quickly moved to a change management role in tech projects. So moving from a manual pick list in a warehouse to an automated pick list, and you know the people implications of that amongst other things. And then eventually found myself working in the mortgage industry with my now ex-husband, and did that for 9 years, working on a tech product and working with mortgage brokers, which was amazing. And then had the opportunity to become the CEO for the peak mortgage broking body in Australia 10 years ago, and then moved from there to scale a fintech, a two-sided marketplace with an Indian founder who is an absolute gem and a wonderful human. And then was invited to, I suppose, apply for the Director of Innovation at ACS, and took on that role for about 3 years. And then most recently in another couple of roles in ACS, which has ended me in the Chief Growth role. And as a 6'3" lady, apparently it's a good appointment because, you had to be tall to take on that title, apparently.
Well, that's quite the resume. I'm sat here now going, oh my goodness, that is an incredible amount of experience there. But you have just illustrated something that I speak a lot about on this podcast, about very transferable skills. And I, from what I'm sort of sensing from all of the positions that you've had, you'd have learned so much from that position, applied it to the next one, applied it to the next one. But you said at the start you wanted to say yes, and I absolutely love that mentality. I've had the same mentality throughout my career and life as well. But I also know that it's for a lot of people, saying yes means stepping out of their comfort zone and, you know, believing in themselves. So I think you learn a lot about a person from looking back at their childhood and their upbringing. So could we go there a little bit? Could you maybe describe your childhood, your upbringing, how you think that sort of shaped you and this ability to say yes and have confidence in yourself?
Yeah. Look, I think it's like any childhood, it's multifaceted and, you know, and kind of confusing and not always clear. You know, my parents came from Ireland in 1970 on a boat. They both worked in factories and, you know, blue collar environments. My mother left school at 13. You know, we lived kind of week to week. It wasn't exactly Angela's ashes, using the Irish analogy, but, you know, there was not a lot of money left at the end of a week to do anything other than survive. And I really think that deeply informed my perspective that you needed to have not only the education to get a job that you want to have, not a job you have to have, which is what I saw both my parents do, but also more importantly, choice in what you do with your life, whether that be through a degree or through anything else. So, and not living week to week, because that, you know, that's a life for many, many people and it's really hard. So that, I think they were two formative pieces. I think the other element for my younger years, I was, and I use the term fortunate or the adjective fortunate in probably a bizarre structure, but I was fortunate to have ovarian cancer when my youngest daughter was 9 months old. And I think that that helps give you another perspective on life about, you know, gosh, you know, rather, what is it, Jim Carrey says, you'd rather fail at doing something that you really want to do rather than fail at something that you don't want to do. So I think that that also informs, you know, go out there and do what, you know, you think is interesting or that you think can challenge you, because you don't always get a second chance.
Yeah, wow. I think a diagnosis like that, to be confronted with the C word, is kind of a very quick way of putting things into perspective. And I can imagine your thought process now is that, well, if I can go through that, then nothing else really can compare. So it's like, I will say yes, because, you know, you're going to have that different approach to life of just life can be short and it can be taken away from you quite quickly. And I think that it's interesting, because I think anyone that I've spoken with that has gone through something similar to that, they have a very different outlook and perspective on life, and a very almost like positive. And like you said, I love the way you framed it as it was a really positive thing, because a lot of people then would go on to live their life with fear of it, maybe going through something like that again. And you've just sort of like gone, I'm just going to keep on going. I'm going to use this now to fuel me and to make sure I say yes and carve out a fantastic life. And there's just, I find that so inspiring. But I want to just really tap in, because I think I always think success leaves clues. And I don't think you get to where you are today without having some form of, like I said, self-belief, but mindset. So you've dealt with cancer. You've grown up in a family that, you know, weren't particularly, you know, well, they certainly weren't rich. They were sort of like living week to week. So where has that mindset come from? Like, were you born with quite a resilient, adaptable mindset? Well, could you pinpoint a few things?
I think the childhood definitely lends itself to being resilient in all that entailed. But I think the other big learning or perspective piece for me was actually picking up and doing martial arts since I was about eight. So I started that at, as I said, eight, judo initially. Then I moved to kung fu after a couple of years. Then I did taekwondo through high school. And then I moved into a style called hapkido when I was 19 till about 34, in which I hold a black belt. And it's interesting, you know, the thing that I didn't realize it for quite a few years in business, but so many years of martial arts does inform your perspective. It's like anything. If you do something long enough, you don't realize it becomes just part of your normal DNA. And, you know, when you think of anyone on the call that's listening today to the podcast has done martial arts, you appreciate you wear a gi. The gi is a sign of equality. There's no boy or girl. There's no wealth or poverty. There's definitely no color of skin acknowledged. There's simply what belt you're wearing, what you're learning, and or what you can demonstrate. And then, you know, if you demonstrate merit and capability, you potentially have that chance to move to a different belt, shall we say. And I think that was the lens I took into business. I didn't see business through a lens of gender. I thought I needed to have particular skills. You know, obviously in some of my career choices, that was basically a degree plus some, you know, hardworking, you know, development of skills on the job. But after a due period, I was keen to say, well, what's my next opportunity? What's my next belt, shall we say? And I didn't expect to be treated differently, but I definitely didn't expect as a woman to be disadvantaged either. And over the years of my career, I have heard women at times discuss their experiences and how they may have interpreted something that was discriminatory to them or may have indeed been discriminatory to them. I suppose I never gave myself the view that it was happening, if it was, and if I felt it was happening, and of course it has happened to me as well. I'm not saying I'm immune to it because of this perspective, but I was quickly in a position to triage it and address it because I wasn't going to accept because I was a woman or I wore a dress that suddenly I should be treated differently. And that even happened in my martial arts experience. I remember training at a different studio, and not to bore the story for too long, but one of the things that we did was a jumping cat roll. So you'd run up and jump, and you'd jump over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people lying down on a mat. And I remember at one of the studios I trained at, the master said after 3 people, okay, everyone in the studio that's a female can sit down now. And I walked over and said, I'm sorry, do you mean if we're not comfortable to proceed or because we're a female? He looked at me and he said, oh, no, the girls just normally sit down at 3. I said, I would probably hazard a guess it's because you've always told them to sit down after 3. If you're okay, I'd be happy to proceed. But if it's against the dojo, I won't. Oh, no, of course, you can continue. Okay, great. So it's that mindset that and we all have biases. I have them as well. But if we allow them to feed into our decisioning in business, particularly or in our personal lives, it puts us at a disadvantage. So I think not seeing business through that lens has been beneficial to me. And definitely that martial arts experience has been definitely beneficial.
I can definitely see how that would have had a really, really positive impact on your mindset. But, you know, I think there will be people listening to this right now. And I know I speak to a lot of women that feel a bit invisible in their current organization, or maybe feel like they're not getting the opportunities that their male counterparts are getting. And look, unfortunately, I'm speaking to a lot of females every day when I'm recruiting, and they're not sort of, they're leaving organizations because they don't feel seen, valued and heard. They want to work for other places. Like, any advice, like, you know, when it comes to developing that mindset and that sort of self-belief and self-worth that you would suggest a female sort of start to really sort of build that sense of worth in herself?
I think it does start with the individual, and we need to, you know, even if it comes to affirmations in your mirror, in front of your mirror as a younger woman or a middle-aged woman or older woman, it's never too, you know, early to start those if you feel that provides benefit to, you know, being able to, I think there's a poem, you know, do you know the man in the mirror? And, you know, let's use that term broadly, you know, do you like the person you see when you look in the mirror, and not about your hair or your eye color, all those such physical attributes, but are you a nice person? Are you a good friend? Are you a good listener? These are sort of attributes that ideally we should all, men and women, be able to articulate when you see yourself reflected. So I think starting with yourself is super important. But I said on a panel once, years ago now, I was on a panel with 3 other really, you know, amazing women, and a woman put her hand up and she asked the panel for their perspective on how to deal with men that speak over them in a boardroom. And my fellow panelists, you know, empathized, which was fine. And I'm a little bit of the anti kind of person on panels sometimes, and for hopefully the right reasons. And I sort of said, look, do you mind if I ask you more questions, and feel free to tap out with any of the answers at any point? She said, no, that's fine. I said, do you have siblings? Yes. Are they brothers in that? Yes. I said, think about the last time you had a family lunch or a family birthday. And she said, yeah. I said, now, when you spoke and your brother or your father spoke over you, what did you do about it then? And it was like a light bulb moment for her. And she was like, oh, wow. And I'm like, we can't presume that behaviors that happen around us and we allow to happen around us to suddenly be different because we've walked into an Oval Office with 12 chairs. That's not where the behavior starts. You know, we appoint people to boards because of their experience at C-suite. Ideally, we've triaged that sort of conduct if it happens, and it does happen at a C-suite level or even early in our career. So I think there's some perceptions of, oh, now I'm a woman. If that happens, someone else should take care of it. We've always got to be the architect of our own destiny, in my opinion. And, you know, that doesn't always mean we as individuals have all our own answers, but at least when we see something happening, we might reflect on it later and talk to a couple of key colleagues or friends, they can be male or female, and say, look, you know, I didn't know how to deal with this situation when it happened, what would you have done and how would you suggest I address that if it happens next time or now after the event? Those sort of conversations, I think, is very reflective of, you know, it's your ability to go away and think about, I didn't really love that and I would like that have gone differently. What would that have looked like if it had gone differently? So I think encouraging that reflective behavior is super important. So when you get to a latter part of your career, they are more automatic and they don't tend to happen at the same frequency as they perhaps do when you're younger.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I reflect on my own career, I think that as I've become older and more sure of myself, and if something happens now, I'll sort of call out in real time. But perhaps in my sort of early 20s when I was new to the workforce, and I hate to say it, but yeah, quite a few things happened that I probably just sort of dismissed because I didn't want to cause a fuss or a scene, or, you know, I didn't want to be seen as the awkward or annoying one. So I was like, oh, I'll just let that slide, that comment, that remark, that little thing that just happened. I'll just pretend I didn't hear. But yeah. Now, oh, you better. I'm calling that out. But it, again, it's a journey and people need to go on it. And I think a lot of it comes with time and wisdom and that sort of reflective piece, like you just said then.
Just on one of those, actually, Georgie, I remember a comment I used to say, I haven't had to say it for a long time, but rather than when someone says something that makes you feel uncomfortable that in a mixed context, rather than saying, did you say, or, you know, you say, oh, I'm sorry, what did you say again? With a bit of a smile on your face. So it allows them either to double down or retract and say, oh, no, I was just joking. It was just a flyaway comment. So just that simple, sorry, what did you say again, with a smile, looks, you know, very agreeable without, you know, being, you know, I suppose sometimes people frame it as, oh, she was so aggressive, she jumped on me straight away type, you know, adage, which we hear on occasion.
I really like that. I'm going to use that one. I'm sure lots of people listening and are writing that down right now.
Takeaway tip
yeah,
one.
Correct. Actionable tip next time I'm in the boardroom with Bob. Perfect. Well, look, I also love to now sort of dive into your career, because you just sort of said, you seem the sort of person that's kind of got a bit of a plan, got a bit of a vision for her life. But has this been sort of planned and mapped out, or have you just kept on saying yes to opportunities as they presented themselves? Like, how have you sort of worked your way sideways, up, zigzag to the position that you're at now?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think there's 70% intentional. And, you know, I love that adage of, you know, you're lucky, and luck is defined by when opportunity meets preparation. So always be prepared. And I'll give you a side story on that in a moment. But where I've always been clear about being in a senior leadership role, that was, I initially aspired that to be in hospitality. So running a restaurant or running a hotel was my initial thoughts. That then moved into general business. But I've always been passionate about the customer, that being both the employee and the external customer. And yeah, it's probably in the last 20 years been very passionate about small business. You know, it's a backbone of our country. There's more people that run businesses that employ less than 250 people than do have more than 250 people. So how do we help those stakeholders, those business owners, to not only sustain the employment that they're providing for these wonderful mums and dads around the country and, you know, first-time workers, but more of them, you know, if possible, particularly with the advent of tech. And I know we're going to talk a bit more about tech. But, you know, we talked before about my martial arts background. I remember, you know, my 20s going into a nightclub in the city and finding out the manager of the bar was a kung fu master. And, you know, after a couple of chats, he was like, oh, you know, if you get your security license, I'll put you on the door. And I was like, okay, that sounds fun. So I went off and got my security license. And, you know, right as rain, within 2 weeks, I was working door work. And then through that opportunity, I was asked to do more particular security work, which required a gun license. So I went off and got a gun license and got a bus license and a motorbike license and tactical driving skills, and ended up doing pretty specialized personal protection work for famous people in Sydney. But when I went for the role at Armaguard at 24 as a female in HR, the gentleman I'd replaced was 44, and all the staff at leadership level were men. And one of the final questions was, oh, you know, Siobhan, to take on this role, you will have to get a security and gun license. Would that be an obstacle? And not only was it not an obstacle, I was very happy to say, oh, no, I've already got both of those. And I remember the CEO almost falling off his chair thinking, what does a 24-year-old woman have a security and gun license outside of working in security? Not that I put door work on my resume. So that was sort of not luck per se, but it was, you know, opportunity and preparation coming together.
That is just Incredible. And what are the chances? It's almost like the universe aligned there for you, like, oh, this is what I have. But again, what I love about that story is that you were constantly just upskilling, constantly like just acquiring more skills and knowledge. And then, like you say, when the opportunity arised, you were ready for it. I think that's just so powerful. But let's talk about when you joined ACS now, because I think I'd love to actually dive into more about your role in that company, because that sounds like a really interesting role. So what does a typical day look like for you at the minute?
Yeah, so great question. It's hard to probably articulate without perhaps giving you some other examples. So ACS, for those that are listening that are not aware, we're a peak body for individuals in the tech sector in Australia. And this year there'll be a million people that associate with working in the tech sector. And we also have some major government contracts where we assist with skills assessment for those coming to the country with their tech qualifications. And we also manage the professional year program for international students that are educated in Australia. So a couple of feathers to our bow, shall we say. We've been around 57 years, so we're an overnight success like most businesses. So my job is quite broad. I have major remit over our branch network Australia-wide, our career pillar, building capability, and obviously the migration pathway components I talked about, which is all the delivery arms of the business. But like, you know, massaging a leg when you've got a sore back, the delivery arms do not work without the supporting arms of accounting, finance, marketing, member services, et cetera. So in aspects of the business, I suppose a typical day is helping my team. I suppose the analogy I might use is it's like running down a paddock. You're trying to ensure that your team continually can run down the paddock without obstacles. And as they get an obstacle, they might kick the ball to me or the challenge to me. I try and triage it so they can keep moving down and keep delivering and keep moving forward. But that could be people, process, marketing, branding, writing a letter, reviewing a report, engaging consultants. Yeah, everything in sundry.
And how did the role come about? Did you apply for the opportunity? Was the position created for you? Like, talk to me about how you stepped into that position.
Yeah, it's a good question. So the previous CEO who unfortunately had to leave through health reasons at the end of last year, Chris Vienne, lovely human being and a great CEO, had been traveling, based out of the US initially and came to Australia for this opportunity. So it was a really good opportunity to work alongside him. He was trying to, I suppose, restructure some aspects of the business and curated this position to, I suppose, help drive the delivery of new products, services, and our delivery arm, so that customer component, which is probably one of my strengths, appointed me into that role, yeah, from the innovation spaces where I'd been working with tech founders to sustainably scale their businesses.
I really want to get into that piece because there's a lot of entrepreneurial and business owners that listen to this podcast, as well as career professionals. So I definitely want to dive down that, because the rate of change in technology is so rapid at the minute, and people are kind of freaking out a little bit about like, what does this mean for my business, blah, blah, blah. But before we get into that, I just want to ask you one sort of final question, because you do strike me as somebody that's very ambitious, very career driven. And, you know, obviously you've got a lot of responsibility in your current role. I always love to like pick people's brains on this, because I've got my own thoughts on this, but how do you balance work and life? Do you believe in it? Like how do you sort of go about family and career?
Yeah, well, I'm doing a bad job of it right now because my daughters are in the house and I haven't said hello properly. So they've come in from school, so we'll get onto that at the end of the podcast. But in broad terms, it is a balance. Of course it is. And I don't subscribe to the idea that you can have everything and spin every plate, because inherently, plates fall over. And again, I'll use the analogy of martial arts, but it's like the Chinese circus where they have the big bamboo poles and they spin the China plates. And, you know, if you've ever had the pleasure of seeing that, they can get up to 8 or 9 plates. But if they lose the balance on one of the poles, one will fall and the plate breaks. So I think it's about being understanding of what your priorities are. And family has been and will always be my number one priority. Obviously, career is super important to me, and family would be the two components. And, of course, my health and your mental, balance, your mental health as well is super important. So How does that all happen? I think I've heard myself say before, I look at employment through three pillars. There's a job, which is sort of more akin to what my mother and father had. It's not something they grew up thinking they were going to do, but, you know, it's what ended up being their choice of payment and how to put a roof over their family's head. A career, which is probably like a large proportion of people that have a degree and or formal qualifications and have a job that they like, but they're pretty happy on a Friday to walk away and, you know, pursue other side hustles or gardening or, you know, whatever it may be. And the third for me is a passion point. So business to me is a genuine puzzle. I quite like the idea of something like a Woolworths and a Coles effectively being the same product with a different wrapper on the tin. Yet if you talk to people in social settings, some people are very passionate about Coles versus very passionate about Woolworths. And I find those sort of dynamics about branding and, you know, pricing and, you know, messaging, how people kind of subscribed more passionately to one or the other. And there are, you know, components of a business that you have at your disposal that you can manipulate with the finite resources of any organization. How do you manage that balance and those priorities to get the best outcome for those finite resources and the market? So for me, that's really interesting. And I find that a passion point. So when I go on holidays, as an example, I would take textbooks with me or business books and read them at a resort on a beach. That's literally my game, which sounds awfully sad, but it's what I find interesting. So yes.
It doesn't sound sad at all because I do exactly the same thing.
All right. Sorry, that's when I've lost all the listeners on the podcast. No, I'm like, yeah, she sounds a bit psycho.
No, I'm not sat there reading a fiction book. I take the time. I think, you know, time is really, really precious and we've only got an allocated amount of time. So, you know, I think for me, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, like I always just want to be learning. I love to learn. I absolutely love diving into a particular topic. You know, at the moment I'm fascinated by, you know, artificial intelligence, but also like the human skills, emotional intelligence, and how that's going to play a really big role in the future of work and really sort of upskilling myself there. But I'm like you, I just love to learn. And when I'm on holiday and I'm relaxed and there's nothing much else going on around me, it's the perfect time. I absorb so much. So if I'm, you know, led on a beach, for example, I just got a podcast or a book. So I totally get it. But how important is that piece, do you think, for people to just constantly be upskilling and learning and, you know, just acquiring these new skills?
So I'm going to take it, I think it's really important, but I'll take it back a step earlier, I think, in the motivation point. I think it's around having a curious mind. And being motivated and being, I suppose, surprised by life or surprised by what's around us. So that would be more my aspiration for people, is more to be kind of curious about things, how that manifests. So it could be just YouTube channels. It doesn't have to be formal courses, for instance. It could be drawing. It could be, you know, colouring in books for adults. That's a really mindful thing. It could be picking up, as my husband would describe it, a box with some strings and teaching himself the guitar 10 years ago. It doesn't matter what it is. I think that just stretching yourself around what the universe around us is super interesting. So whatever engages you, go with that and try and participate more than just your standard 9-to-5, because you're a long time, you know, retired. And if you can't work or you leave a job, you're quickly replaced. So your career should not be what defines you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I wanted to quickly pop in and talk to you about our amazing supporter, CH Talent Solutions. We are an IT and digital recruitment company based in Australia. If you are someone right now looking for a new opportunity or considering a career pivot, please reach out to one of our consultants. Or if you are somebody looking to build your team or build your company or scale, again, please reach out to us if you are looking to find the best tech talent fast. I look forward to connecting with you. Now back to today's episode. Enjoy. I absolutely love that. And talking about being replaced, there's a lot of people I speak to now thinking they're going to be replaced by AI robots. And I'm not going to lie, I was watching something on YouTube the other day about the Tesla robot. And I was literally like, oh my God, Terminator's here. Like I had this sort of like, it was scary. I was a bit like, wow, we are advancing super quick. And I'm just like, part of me wants to press the pause button. Part of me wants to embrace it. I'm like you, I'm naturally curious. I'm naturally a positive person. So I'm thinking this will be positive, but What advice are you giving for those small businesses out there that, you know, are concerned for their business, for their job? Like, what, how should we be thinking about this new tech?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the past is a good predictor of the future when it comes to an individual's behavior. So it's an adage in HR. So the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. I think if we look at industries where tech has disrupted previously, and I agree with you, Georgie, the pace is substantive, and I'll give you an example of that in a moment, but we've always had more jobs created. So there wasn't as much, or I don't recall anyway, I'm happy to be proven wrong, but when marketing went to digital marketing, there was a lot around commentary of, you know, newspapers being disrupted and online papers, et cetera. But we never talked about digital marketers, SEO experts and, you know, keyword people. It was just, it just happened. It just, people evolved in these skills and there was sort of micro courses and people then started having it as part of their degree. That pace was a little bit more perhaps digestible and easier for people to participate in or follow with. And there were services by the web providers, so AWS, Google, they provided some solutions if you're an SME in relation to how best to adopt this. And let's just talk about the pace for a moment. I was on a panel again recently talking about this and I kind of gave it in the perspective of how long it takes for a brand, a consumer brand, to reach 100,000 customers. So Netflix, it took 10 years, Facebook, 4.5 years, TikTok, 9 months, generative AI, 60 days. So wow. That's the pace that you were talking about, which I agree with. Mm-hmm. I think from an SME, let's go back to that, which I talked about before as well. I think it's really hard to, you know, I suppose, keep abreast of how do I work on my business as well as in my business. And so many people are spending so many hours in their business. It's really difficult to say, actually, I just need to, and I always use the analogy, step on the side mills of the treadmill, you know, the side rails. So the treadmill keeps going because we can't stop time, as we all understand. But how do you just take a breather and look at the treadmill and look at the situation you're in, reflect on, have a water break, have a think, digest, jump back on the treadmill? If we're constantly on the treadmill, we're probably going to miss opportunities. And, you know, happy for people if they're an SME and you know, have a question about, you know, tech or anything, hit me up on LinkedIn, happy to respond to that if I can or via your podcast. But I think you just need to spend some time intentionally looking at your business, not just working in your business, is the first practice. You know, it's consciously competent about doing that. And then you might go, well, great, I've done that, Siobhan. Now what do I do? I've got 2 hours a week I've put in my diary, but what am I fixing or what am I working on? And then that's the second conversation. It's, you know, what are the threats? What are the opportunities? How can you improve productivity rather than be concerned about the tech? How can we perhaps learn more about it and how can it help us?
Mm. Yeah, I think about that a lot. And I love what you just said then about working in versus on, because I'm a small business owner myself. I have a recruitment company and we recruit in technology. So I've always been very aware of what's going on in tech and what's coming and things. And hence why I'm really passionate about the whole diversity piece, which I know we're going to go and speak about, and how I want to make sure that the younger generation of females don't get left behind, because all the jobs of the future are going to have a technology component to it. And I want to make it accessible for all. But I think the worst thing that people can do right now is bury their heads in the sand, that ostrich effect. The tidal waves come in and they just want to ignore it. And then all of a sudden they're going to wake up one day and they're going to be like, oh God, I am really far behind. But when you sort of look at like AI and all that sort of technology, what actually excites you? And how, if you were a small business owner right now, what would you be sort of like curious about looking into, any sort of like particular products or like ChatGPT or something like that, that you go, oh, look, I'd be sort of thinking about this or this, like any advice to small business owners that they could be sort of looking into at the moment from that tech component?
So for me, it's always data tells you where your opportunities are. So if you're looking at, you know, not that we're all CFOs, but if you run your own business, you've probably got to be a CFO by bootcamp. You've got to know your numbers. You've got to know where your expenses are going out the door and where your revenue opportunities are. So basic ledger of left and right, where is your biggest spend is where you potentially have the biggest opportunity. And most businesses, it's in talent, it's in staff. So how can I help lift the productivity of my staff? So, you know, and I won't give any particular kind of role type because I don't want, you know, oh, they said this role would be extinct and I'm not going to say that. But if you look at, you know, examples where you could do, you know, what an A-B split test is on a website. So you have the same website, yep, and you try different fonts or colors or call to actions. you could trial that in an AI, generative AI engine. If I did this marketing to this customer, what would be the response versus, so testing rather than having perhaps marketing people, you know, they say with the marketing, if you have $100, spend $90 working out who you want to speak to and $10 speaking to that person. It's unfortunately, we do a lot of scatter and spray. So I think being really clear about, well, how would I test some of these things before I spend the money behind doing them? I think that would be my first thing. I'd look at where have you got talent? What can you do to help optimize them, make them more efficient? What things, tools, particularly AI, generative AI to help with that? But be also being balanced with whatever you put into a generative AI engine. Be very clear that you've now added that content, could be proprietary to your business, out into the World Wide Web. So hence we have organizations and tools that are coming in, which is a gated generative AI, shall we describe it as. So it's contained to your perimeters of your business, so you can use it within the confines of your business without fearing such things. But if I was to put in five, private letters I'd written and say, write a letter to my mother based on the content of these five letters, I've now just given over five letters into the World Wide Web. So just being aware of the pros and cons of the tool as well, you need to be a bit aware.
I think that's such solid advice. I love what you said then, is like, look at what costs you the most time and money and think about that. But you're so right. People are definitely the biggest source of time and money. But going back to the whole productivity piece, because again, curious mind, but we use AI a lot in our business. For example, the podcast, right? What used to take us 3 hours to edit a podcast now takes us 30 minutes because we pop it into a tool and it basically just cuts up and edits all the podcasts, spits out the key pieces. I mean, it's just incredible. 3 hours or 30 minutes, just like that. Like, wow. Amazing. Like, that's
so this
just one
hour discussion could end up being a 10-minute podcast that takes out all the rubbish she doesn't want to hear about.
All the ifs and buts and maybes and gone. But no, it's fascinating. And I remember like going, this is a game changer. Yes. And then there's a couple of other things that we do as well. But that's just one example that saved us literally 2.5 hours in our week, which is incredible. And you just imagine what you could do.
Aware of tools that they're using in, traditional fashion photography, which is basically filming it now, and then the AI engine picks whatever screen is the best for the photo, rather than taking static photos and, optimizing those photo finishing those photos better. So it's all different applications, and I think we just need to be open to that. Our evidence at ACS, we do an annual report every year called the Digital Pulse, and it's in partnership with Deloitte Access Economics. And last year was our 9th edition. Obviously, this year we're launching our 10th at the August, September, I think. And it identified, obviously, it charts the growth of the tech sector, which is, no surprise, growing year on year faster and faster, 8% in the last 12 months. But it also, this report looked at the impact of critical technologies on the broader workforce. And, what it showed us is that about 90% of the workforce in some shape or form will need some form of reskilling. So I think if you combine some of the comments we've talked about already, Georgie, that sense of being curious, that sense of actually I could do, side hustle or try this course or do that micro-credential, those are things that will help keep you in good stead. And there is one example I will give. So we talk about roles as a combination of skills. So to be a podcaster or a producer and a recruitment managing director, you need certain skills to do your role. An accounts payable clerk is a role that by analysis shows us that it's highly likely to be fully automated in a 5-year horizon, with tools that are available. But interestingly, 80% of the skill stack is the same as 80% of the skill stack for a cyber analyst. So rather than having a colleague in your business that you think, well, that role is going to be redundant or automated, bye-bye. What about saying, hey, gosh, we could train you for these other 20% differential and move you into the tech team and be one of our trainee cyber analysts and, have an ongoing career? That's the level of understanding we need to get to and more information. There's lots of tools that are coming to market to help with that. But that's sort of the level of skill development we're talking about. So it's not about one out, one in, particularly with cyber talent. There's such a limited amount of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, and only 17% of it is females. That's what I read the other day as well. And it's the number one skill, according to LinkedIn jobs, that the number one, that's the skill that's going to be in 2024, cyber analyst. So that, but what you just said then is like, that accountant is not thinking like that. But no. I want them to start thinking like that. And this is really, really important. Like you think like all the people that were doing, you know, just not even like marketing, but not online marketing, all the people that are skilled in social media and understand all the social media platforms, like they've gone on to really excel in their careers. And it's just like, we really need to have this adaptability mindset, this curious mindset that we've been speaking about throughout this podcast, because that's what's going to make sure that you get ahead and don't fall behind. But when it comes to falling behind, the one thing that I can't ignore, and it's why I do this podcast, it's why I co-founded Sisterhood Club Initiative, is all the opportunities coming in technology and the lack of females coming through. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be getting, look, it is improving, but not at the rate that I'd like it to. We're still females leaving the technology space. So I'd love to get your thoughts on this, because I'm sure you've got live data of what is actually going on, like what can be done.
so let's talk about how we might boil the ocean. So unfortunately, our data shows this, is, again, trends that you're talking about, but even more surprising, last year's digital poll showed that the participants in the tech sector that, you know, define themselves or associate as being women or female went backwards for the first time in our data collection for 9 years. So that was to 29%. So 29% of the workforce are women, and that's alarming from my perspective. And it's interesting. So we have, you know, let's talk about gender stereotypes, which are often touted around, that men are more, you know, risk tolerant than women, their female counterparts. So if you were to apply that to tech, we're a growing sector that's growing at a higher rate than the average overall workforce. So job security, you could infer, is high. We pay on average higher salaries than the rest of the overall workforce. So that's another tick. And yet we see such a small participation rate of females. Now, there's not a lot of data. There isn't around the startup space and the scale-up space about some of the issues that are affecting female participation. But tech in broader terms, again, compared to other industries, tends to be more diverse than traditional industry, and has a higher, you know, with people with disability as well, a neurodiversity amongst, you know, women. But we're simply not attracting enough women from school. That's standard, and even boys and girls. I think STEM might be a bit of a repellent. We've been talking about it for 10 years, and yet the numbers are plummeting. I've often joked, Georgie, that if only the Kardashians coded, we probably wouldn't have a problem. But and sadly, I think Kim became a lawyer, didn't she, or something?
Yeah.
So, and then the other data point, which I found is really interesting, it's probably my background as well. I wasn't trained in tech, but I entered the tech sector, and about 50% of women in the sector have come through non-traditional pathways. And I think that's a really big opportunity. And it could be things like my first exposure really in a tech term was on the change management project I was on, which was moving from paper-based to a headset-based in a warehouse environment for Woolworths. And all the nuances about that, how we would code it, and, you know, I was involved in all of those discussions, and I was like, wow, this is really interesting. But I wasn't reliant on being the domain knowledge expert. I was the change management expert. And then I moved more broadly into a project management role, and then more a software business where I was sort of running the operations of it. Again, not having to be the person coding. I've never coded in my life and don't aspire to do so. Nothing wrong with it, but I think a lot of women often think or associate or conflate that IT means I need to code, and nothing is less true.
Exactly that. And that's what we need to move away from, that narrative. But I even interviewed Sarah Carney, who's the CTO of Microsoft now. She comes from the military, then she went into law, then she finally reached Microsoft and worked her way up. Now she's CTO and she doesn't code. And I was like, this is exactly, you'd think though, people would have the perception she must be a really good developer to get that role at CTO at Microsoft. And it's like, it's just not the case. And like you just said then, so many women and people in general now don't come from an IT background. And what I think the problem is like a lot of organizations that want to say, I want to recruit more women, but then I'm having conversations with them and I'm saying, I have to have a degree in technology. And I'm just like pushing back and being like, well, then, you know, you're not going to get a female, because most females that I'm working with right now don't have a degree in technology.
Yeah.
So It's corporates have got to take responsibility for. I think the way they write the job descriptions is just like, you're not going to attract females that way. So let's look at this from like a corporate perspective now. Like, what can companies be doing to try and attract more females into their business from that tech perspective?
From our research, I think you're tackling it from exactly the right perspective. And so it is, I feel more, it needs to be done at the industry side, not the applicant side. There's a lot of people that have got, and it's interesting, the same data that talks about, 97% of tech roles say you need to have a degree. But the top three attributes they're talking about is problem solving, teamwork, and communication skills. Exactly. So there has to be a balance and a high proportion. Our report again last year talked about the idea that one in three graduates from a tech qualification, industry does not think that they're ready for work. So there's a whole bunch of information that says to us, well, actually, they're not ready. So when I think about employment, and I have for a long time, and I'm going to advocate that you feel in a similar way with your role, but it's a two-way street. I mean, the employer is obviously looking for the best talent they can afford for the price, but equally the employee should be viewing it as, is this where I'm going to thrive and my career needs may be met and I might get the right opportunities? And it's a two-way discussion for that's been my lens at all time. And if you're someone in industry and you are not thinking differently about your recruitment or your talent strategy, you are simply missing out on the best talent. That would be my advocacy, because those that think differently, those that have flexible hours, those that don't say every role has to be 40 hours a week, there are different ways of attracting people and getting the right attitudes and, team dynamic. And particularly if you're developing products for customer consumption, if the team that's developing them is not reflective of the customers in which you're trying to sell it to, I think there's a really big risk that, the product may not be successful.
I completely agree. And I think that's why like D&I, like at the minute, I feel like people are like kind of getting a bit like, oh, eye roll about it. But, it needs to still be discussed. Like even the recent stats coming out from all about the gender pay gap. And like, we're not sort of getting where we need to be. So these conversations still need to be had and they will continue to be had until such time change is actually made. Right. So, but yeah, you're so right. And I think like diversity is one thing, inclusion is another. And this is the other piece that maybe mildly frustrates me is that, you'll get companies with very good intentions that want to hire for more diversity, but then their culture isn't very inclusive. So that's the other piece to it. So advice for like companies that want to maybe improve their cultures and bring in people and have that sort of sense of belonging. You've come from as your HR background, like any advice for companies wanting to improve their culture and really make it inclusive?
So two things here. Holly Kramer was the ex-CEO of Best & Less through one of their resurgence periods. And she talked about diversity inclusion. I don't think she coined the phrase, but she talked a lot about it as diversity being invited to the party and inclusion being invited to dance. And that to me is a really good visual representation. Just having people in a room or having people on your team from a diversity perspective, if they're never included in decision-making, if they're never consulted on how they feel about a decision being made, then there's no inclusion. It's just simply you're at the table and you're being told what to do by someone who is not reflective of your diverse background. So that's the first thing to think about. There's people, again, in conversations I've had with different stakeholders, I say, well, not everyone wants to share their opinion. I'm like, absolutely, but are you intentionally asking? And it's like, if I'm the loudest voice or I'm an easy contributor in a dynamic and, Georgia, you're not, if I say to you, oh, Georgia, what did you think of Siobhan's suggestion about doing A, B, C, and D? Do you think there'd be some merit there or do you see any risks? Most people are willing to give a statement about an actual idea. Asking them individually for what is your new idea, not always easy for everyone to come up with a new idea, but most people have a comment to contribute to one that's already been put on the table. And it's that intentional reaching out. So that's number one, being aware of the two points. Look, the couple of things I think, and we say it all the time, it's about culture. It is leading from the top. It has to be a passion point from my perspective of the organization. It has to feel real. So where there are elements of the business not aligned to that culture, they can be called out and remedied quickly. And if it doesn't come from the top and there's no support at a business unit level, you're best as a really talented, diverse workforce to go somewhere else, in my opinion. you need to recognize and manage unconscious bias in recruitment terms. We talk about, you know, discrimination, but we don't talk about unconscious bias in an intentional way. So I think that there's value in calling that out, and what does it look like and how do we mitigate it? You know, even getting experts to come in and train you in diversity training if needed. Inclusive job ads. You know, again, we use language sometimes that isn't inclusive, so being clear about what language we're using. Think about different hiring practices, talent strategies. I mean, I could wax lyrical. Go really big with onboarding. I mean, your goal of getting new talent, it takes so much money, time to get someone on board. And then people take, when I was younger, it was a 3-month probationary period. And for most organizations, of course, it's 6 months. And people can take up to 6 months to work out whether someone is, you know, right for the role. Like, could we not still try and identify by 11 weeks if they're right, by giving them the best onboarding experience as possible, so they're up and running and thriving and, you know, delivering value to the team rather than wait for that 6 months and then. So again, and then of course, celebrate. You've got to celebrate and advocate for, you know, great behaviors. So there's a whole bunch of things I think would be valuable.
Yeah, I just think there's so much value in what you just said then. And look, it is... I mean, I could talk about it all day. I'm obviously not going to try and boil the ocean today, but it is a conversation that still needs to be had, unfortunately. And, I started recruiting in technology 10 years ago. I think I can count on one hand the amount of women that I placed, the amount of female hiring managers I met with. So it has come a long way since then. I think people are more aware of it now. I think people actually see the benefit of having diverse teams because, like you just said, we want to, you know, create products for the community and the society that we serve. And I think that's a really important way to look at it. So it is changing. It's probably not changing at the pace I'd like, but I think it's really important to, again, showcase females in tech because you can't be what you can't see. I think that's ultimately very true. And that's why I want to keep on elevating the voices of females that are in this industry. And like I said, who don't come from a traditional coding background, because I think that whole mentality and thing needs to change. But look, what's next for you? I mean, you've achieved so much. Like, I mean, I'm sure you've gone in and you've got some big plans and goals for your current role. So what would you like to achieve, you know, over the next sort of year or two?
So, yeah, I mean, you're right. I've got lots of big opportunities at ACS and we're doing lots of wonderful projects, which keeps my job interesting, which is, I mean, I just want to do interesting things with interesting people. That's been my adage for a long time now. And I'm fortunate that in my career and my experience, I generally have opportunities to do that. So number one, work is great. You know, from a personal side, you know, family, my oldest daughter's doing a HSC this year. So it's a super exciting time for her to finish and to look at her, you know, year 13 plans, you know, degree or travel or whatever that looks like. And my youngest is in year 10. And I'm also, as a family, we're also doing Duolingo. We're learning Spanish.
We're
up to 250 odd days, I think, as a family unit. So probably planning a trip to South America in the coming years would be pretty great.
Fantastic. One of my recent podcasts, I interviewed a lady called Kate who'd written a book called Life List. And she talks about having all these things on your list, which, you know, you want to get done. So it sounds to me like the learning Spanish is working towards this trip to South America, which is really exciting. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
But listen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. I can think of so many more questions I want to ask you, but I'm conscious of time. But look, one thing that I always, you know, want to sort of try and ask as many people on this podcast as possible is, I call this podcast Career Confidence for a reason, because I do think that whole self-worth, self-belief is important and a foundation of what a lot of things are built on. So if you could, I guess, maybe impart one more piece of advice into the people listening to this podcast, like, how have you gone and built your career confidence? And what advice would you have for those perhaps that are struggling right now to believe in themselves and are scared of the future and maybe don't think they've got the capability to learn the new skills that are going to be needed? Like, any advice for that person?
Well, always remember, we were all there once. So I probably come across as confident and capable and skilled now, but, you know, I'm sort of 51 in July, so plenty of years under my belt. So number one, we all started somewhere. Number two, I think it is really important to think about yourself as an individual first. You know, it's the kind of classic, what's the adage, you know, you can't love somebody else until you love yourself. I think there's a strong alignment to work. You can't be really great at work if you don't know yourself, because you don't know your boundaries, you don't know your parameters. So, you know, Toni Collette said, if you don't know yourself, invest the money to do, because you'll end up having a much better life because of it. So, you know, counseling is always really great if you're not sure about where your mind's at, or why your mind is the way it is sometimes, or you feel, you know, despondent or deflated. You know, that's not really how you should feel the majority of the time. It happens to all of us, but it shouldn't be the majority of how you feel. So working on how your motivations are, and, you know, just giving yourself a go. Like, as I said before, what have you got to lose? You literally, there's nothing to lose. Enjoy life, get out there and give it a go, and work with some good people and take some challenges.
Absolutely love it. Siobhan, where can I send people to find out more about yourself? Where do you hang out the most?
Oh, probably LinkedIn. Yeah, LinkedIn is mostly I go to that, and I try to respond to everybody. So if you do reach out and you have a, you know, career question or a business question, I will do my best to respond to you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thank you so much for doing that. And I can't wait to share the next episode with you.